Hey, everyone. You are listening to the Divergent Conversations podcast. We are two neurodivergent mental health professionals in a neurotypical world. I'm Patrick Cassell.
And I'm Dr. Neff.
And during these episodes, we do talk about sensitive subjects, mental health, and there are some conversations that can certainly feel a bit overwhelming. So we do just want to use that disclosure and disclaimer before jumping in. And thanks for listening.
If you're looking to grow your business and get in front of a new audience, Divergent Conversations is accepting new sponsors for the 2024 seasons. We already have over 300,000 downloads and counting all over the world, and this podcast is growing all of the time. The beauty of podcast sponsorship is that you can get live pre-roll or mid-roll opportunities where we will read your ad on air while recording, getting you in front of a new audience every single week. You have the opportunity to sponsor 1 month of episodes at a time, where you'll get 4 episodes in total, or you can sponsor an entire year and be the exclusive sponsor of Divergent Conversations. This is a podcast that's being distributed all over the world. The analytics are fantastic. The podcast is growing, and it is a very captive audience. Reach out to us directly via the link in our website at divergentpod.com. or email us at divergentconversationspodcast@gmail.com, and we can get started on your sponsorship journey.
So, Patrick, today we're talking about sensory shutdown and meltdown. And partly, first of all, you texted me last week. You're like, we should do an episode on this. And my first thought was like, oh my gosh, how have we not done an episode on shutdown and meltdown yet? But I'm curious what prompted you. Like, was it after a shutdown that you're like, let's do a podcast on this?
You know, that's how our lives work. And like, we have these ideas, right? Because we've listed out a ton of topics when we first had the idea to launch this podcast. And then when we meet, or the day that we're going to meet, we text each other and we're like, hey, you want to talk about this? And it could be completely different than what we were going to talk about. I think that's what makes this so fun, is like the ability to just diverge and create. But yeah, I think I was thinking about it because we hadn't done it. We get a lot of DMs to our Instagram that ask specifically for an episode on this topic. Strategies, tips, how it shows up, etc. But I typically have a lot of shutdown moments in my life, so it just was feeling kind of front center.
Yeah, well, and we were in the holiday season, and I think holiday season is a huge sensory shutdown, meltdown territory. Yeah, absolutely. Should we define shutdown and meltdown first? Okay, so yeah, sensory. People are probably a little bit more familiar with sensory meltdown. It's more talked about, but, and I like to link this to nervous system states. I find that helpful. When we're in that sensory meltdown, we're often in that more of that, fight flight energy. And so it's pretty visible to the people around us. And so it's when it's like our brain. Well, it's kind of like our brain is melting from all the sensory overload. And then I know for me, I actually just had a sensory meltdown, which is, I haven't had one in years, Patrick, but I had one last week.
What was going on?
Well, we got a new puppy, so I haven't been sleeping well. And then I forgot how overstimulating puppies are. And he has this really loud, high-pitched bark. We have another, have a niece who's 3, and he doesn't have that kind of, he doesn't bark very much. And so I hadn't slept well. The puppy was being overstimulated. I was trying to like manage the puppy, but then upload something to WordPress, which is a platform I do not understand. And I use Squarespace for my website, but it's a partnership. And I was really frustrated at myself that the person I'm collaborating with had done a walkthrough with me to show me how to upload this stuff, but it was like a month ago and like nothing was working. And you've seen my desktop. I was like trying to find the file and I couldn't even find the file I was trying to upload. So it was like this series of fatigue, sensory overwhelm. I was having a really bad health day And it was just like too much. And I, so I, the way I describe it, like, I feel like I want to lash out, which is, again, very not normal for me. And at times it's looked like lashing out at myself. In adolescence, I think I was having a lot of meltdowns, and that's what led to a lot of my self-harm. So this, there's this like very kind of aggressive needing to lash out. And I see that as like needing to get the energy out is what it feels like. So I'm so not proud of this, but I'm going to say this because a lot of people, a lot of autistic people have a lot of shame around their meltdown. So I'm going to, I'll be really transparent here. In that moment, my husband was in the room and I was like, this was a terrible idea. I think we should give this puppy back. I knew when I said it, there was no way we're like rehoming this puppy or like I like that would crush the kids. It would like that doesn't feel ethical to me. And like I knew it wasn't true, but I said it. And I think what I was saying in that moment is like, it's too much. And then I did. I was like, it's too much. It's too much. And I started to cry and I went upstairs and I put the dogs in their crate and they napped and I napped and then I was tired for the rest of the day, but it was better. Yeah. So like I feel the cortisol when I'm in a meltdown and it feels I'm someone who typically has a lot of control over myself. And so these moments when it feels like I have less control are really disarming. They're really scary. Yeah. So that would be a sensory meltdown. I realized I diverged from like explanation to personal experience. Before I explain shutdown, do you want to add anything about meltdowns or your experience of them?
Yeah. One, I wanted to say, thanks for naming that. I know that's an inside look into what was happening. And I know that was a lot. It sounds like to me, like when you hit that moment, right? And this is just my own experience with any sort of sensory meltdown. When you said, I want to give this dog back or whatever, you were just at your limit. You were just like so overwhelmed and so frustrated and so worn down that was the only way to express those emotions that you were experiencing. And then once you say it out loud, you're just kind of like, yeah, obviously we're not going to do that. And I'm still really overwhelmed. And I find for me, the best answer all the time is that quiet, dark, like I need to sleep. I need to lay down. I just need to be in that state where I can just like melt into the bed and not have to have any responsibilities. And I'm definitely, I will be honest, as I'm watching my two dogs circle each other for a treat that one of them is eating, one of them has created that sensation for me so many times because he's tiny. He has that like high pitched bark. He barks at everything. He is a lot. And I had lived with my dad for about 2 months down in Florida 2 years ago. I had brought both dogs and my dad's house is 900 square feet, 2 beds, 1 bathroom. It was hot. It's humid. It's Florida. Everything that could happen that led to like these sensory meltdowns was happening where our Shih Tzu fur, he was getting like these sticky sapling things in his fur outside in my dad's yard. And I was having to like pull them out and there were so many of them and he was in pain. And then I'm in my dad's house and the dog is barking at everything, whether it's the window, some noise, something that moved. And my dad is getting frustrated. And I'm like, okay, how do I handle this? And then I was like scared to leave my dad's house because I didn't want my dog to just be barking. And then my dad to have to deal with it. So it was becoming this situation where I was literally having these sensory meltdowns on almost multiple times a day. And I was almost, it felt like I was at my wit's end. It felt like I really, like you said, cortisol's ramping up. I also consider myself someone who's pretty in control of how I experience my emotions a lot of the time, or how I at least put them into the world. And I was just getting very short, very frustrated, like no longer could function, right? Even the littlest of tasks become the biggest of tasks and they become almost impossible because my executive function is just out the window. It's just non-existent. I'm like, I can't even think straight right now. And it becomes a situation where like I feel so shameful and so defeated and so overwhelmed and I want to cry and never cry. So it probably would be helpful at those moments. And I just feel lost. Like I don't know what to do. and they do pass, but in those moments, they're really painful and they can
feel terrible,
embarrassing.
Yeah, they're so painful and they're so embarrassing. Like, I felt like the other night, I felt like a child tantruming, and like, I'm a 39-year-old woman or human. I don't like thinking of myself as a woman. That's another story. A 39-year-old human. Who like, yeah, it's so embarrassing. And I hear that a lot from people, that's one of the hardest things about a meltdown is afterwards, like the embarrassment and the shame. And also like they can do a lot of relational damage, right? Like I was talking about my dog and I was able to circle back to my spouse and be like, I didn't actually mean that. I knew I didn't mean it. Here's what was happening. But like, there's scenarios where, you know, maybe that comment, I want to get rid of this puppy, maybe for some people it's, I want a divorce, or I want to, like, you know, be if it's coming out at another person. I think in meltdowns, we can say some really harmful things out of that. It's too much energy. And I think that gets really complicated. And again, we're acting very incongruent from our values in meltdowns for a lot of the time. And so naturally we're going to experience a lot of shame in the aftermath of that.
And I think one thing you just mentioned that I think is important is you said, I'm a 39-year-old person, but I feel like a child. But in those moments, there is a lot of inner child happening, and there's a lot of inner child stuff going on where I think we can all think back to when we were kids, when we weren't attuned to, when we weren't attended to, when we weren't co-regulated with, when we weren't supported in any capacity or unseen, whatever. And you act out, feel like I have to get my point across. I have to be able to express myself. And as adults, we learn, we keep that contained. Like we regulate ourselves. We don't let those emotions come out in a way. And it's almost like this volcano, right? Like it's like bubbling, 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 all of a sudden eruption. And then all of a sudden can't think straight, can't see straight. May say things I may regret, like you said, can have significant damage in relationships, can come across in ways that you don't intend to. And then you immediately go into that shame spiral of like, what did I just do? What did I just say? How did I just react? That was so embarrassing of me. I didn't have control over myself. And we all, I mean, you know, as we center so much in this podcast on autistic experience, but as autistic folks, we want to have control over ourselves, and we like control. And when we are out of control, it feels like we are out of regulation. And like you said, congruency with our colors. Mm-hmm. So,
okay. I like don't even want to go there, but because I don't have an answer, but I want to name it as attention. And this is not where I saw this podcast going, but okay, here's the tension I feel of this idea of like, we don't have control in a meltdown. And that's actually been really helpful also in my parenting of understanding, like if one of my children has a meltdown, like they're not trying to be hurtful. This is not something that they have a lot of control over. And again, I'm not sure, is it that we have no control? Is it that we don't have much control? Like I don't know categorically.
Sure.
But then this idea of like accountability. So let's say we do have a meltdown. And we say something painful, and we also understand we had less control over what we were saying or what we were doing, or if we do something painful, like what does it look like to repair relationally after that? How much accountability should we be having for those moments? Like these are things. And then this is again something that when it's talked about, it's talked about, with a lot of like hushness and quietness and shame. But like, you know, there's a lot of parents out there specifically who are wondering, what do I do when my adolescent has a meltdown and they become aggressive, like toward a sibling or toward me? Like, this is really hard territory we're talking about.
Yeah. Very, very, very hard from that perspective. Like, what do I do with my loved one is becoming aggressive in public? What do I do? You know, and let's say if I'm thinking about my nieces and nephews who are young Black kids in the South, what if that happens in public? There's so many safety risks there in general. then again, once I want to circle back to your mention of control, like, is it no control? Is it limited control? Are we just in a state where it's hard to access that ability to rein it in? I don't know. But I know that there are often ruptures that need to be repaired. And when you mentioned accountability, that's huge, right? Like, if I have a meltdown and I'm with my wife, I will often fall into that shame aspect. I shouldn't have acted like that. I shouldn't have reacted like that. And it takes time for me to regulate and ground and soothe. And then I oftentimes will say to her, hey, this is what was happening. And I'm really sorry that I reacted like that. And she'll always say, I know. And I'm like, well, I guess thank you for understanding. But again, I still want to name and take accountability over that. So that has just come with a lot of these experiences happening and having to really sit with, do I feel like I should be accountable to what just happened? Sometimes it's external, right? Where it's like, I'm not bringing this on to myself. And that's very parenting piece. I can't speak to that, obviously, but like, I imagine that would be so unbelievably challenging and really difficult to figure out, what do I do in a situation if my adolescent is reacting in this way? How do I protect them? How do I protect myself? How do I protect their siblings, friends, etc.? It's really complicated.
Yeah. This is one of those areas that I can think myself in knots over really easily. And like the go-to advice, right, is to do things that reduce the meltdown from happening in the first place, right? So to reduce and just to develop a sensory lens, which I talk about all the time, especially for parents, it's like, okay, think through the sensory context of that. Is there anything that could have been done differently? It's interesting for me, I'm thinking back to that. Like, and I haven't felt like that since I was a parent of young children. And it's, for me, it's really tied to sleep deprivation plus like a sensory overwhelming environment. Like the combination of that, that's like, I would say pretty much the only times I have meltdowns. Otherwise I have shutdowns. And I have so many shutdowns. That's like my default, which we will talk about. But if I could go back, so there's this idea of like behavior chaining in therapy where it's like, okay, after whether it's an emotional meltdown or like a sensory meltdown, you go back and you like, because in the moment, it feels like things go from 0 to 100, but actually they're going a little bit slower. So you dissect it second by second. At what point was there an exit ramp? So for me, if I go back to this last weekend, when I had a puppy that was yipping next to me and I was trying to do something complex technology and with executive functioning, like at some point, if I could have accessed my narrator, it would have been like, okay, you're not going to get this thing uploaded. I know you really want to, because you want to get something off your to-do list today. Let's pivot, or let's ask your spouse to take the dog and you can go focus. But there would have, like, looking back, I can see like, okay, there was an exit ramp there that I didn't take. And I know it would have been harder for me to take because I was not in a great space. But that sort of reflection for me has been really helpful to like dissect the experience and to identify what were the exit ramps I could have taken. Because in doing that, it means I'm more likely next time to see the exit ramps and be like, oh, this is where, like, this is not working. I need to take this exit ramp.
Yeah, absolutely. I like that strategy. Because that also, those exit ramps kind of reframe the control piece that we just talked about. Like, do I have control? If there are exit ramps available that we can become more aware of, then there is more of a likelihood that you have control to make that decision, to step away, to remove yourself, to ask for support, et cetera. So I think that's a really great exercise.
Ooh, and now let's overlay it with attachment theory. I just had this thought. Okay, so let's say you're partnered, and let's say you're with a partner who has a more anxious attachment. Conflict can be, like, just the emotions of that can be really sensory overwhelming. So I could imagine there's a point in conflict where the autistic person needs an exit ramp if they're not going to have a sensory meltdown. And I would say a sensory meltdown in middle of conflict is a really bad idea. Like, you're going to say painful, hurtful things that you will later feel terrible about and that you probably don't mean. But the anxiously attached partner might have a really hard time letting the autistic person take that exit ramp. And so, like, again, having like a pregame, I don't know why I'm doing so much, I'm doing weird metaphors today, a pregame like plan of when I hit my limit, I need to take space away. And I need a word I can say that, you know, that I'm coming back, but I have to take a step away. Because I think, yeah, that's one dynamic I could see getting really tricky.
And now we are going to take a quick break to thank our sponsors. Being a clinician in today's medical or mental health care field can be so overstimulating. Do you feel like you're just being pulled in every direction when you're listening to your patients? It can be so hard to keep your focus on them as well as take adequate notes. If this is you, we have the answer. Freed AI listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you, written in your style and ready the moment the visit is over. No more overstimulation. No more letting things fall through the cracks. Freed is HIPAA compliant, secure, and it takes less than 30 seconds to learn. More importantly, Freed supports your executive function skills so you can get back to doing what you love, helping your clients. Go to getfreed.ai and use code DCPOD for your first month free. That's getfreed.ai and use code DCPOD. Thanks for hanging around, and now we're jumping back in.
Absolutely. That's a great point. So having that code word or phrase, or just having a conversation as like a blueprint of, if this is what's happening, here's an internal like glimpse into my reality. I always find that can be useful to say, like, this is what's happening. It has nothing to do with you. I need to away so I can circle back so we can have a conversation that doesn't, you know, rupture, that doesn't need to be repaired. Easier said than done, but certainly a thing that can be done. I'm thinking of a specific sensory meltdown experience. We just did an episode on reflecting on the new year. Last year, right after throat surgery in New Orleans, first retreat of the year, January. So 2 months after throat surgery, definitely not ready to be working in that capacity by any means. I just remember being in the kitchen, 25 other people, no one's doing anything wrong. Everyone's talking, socializing, etc. My executive functioning really starts to diminish. My sensory system really starts to struggle. Everything becomes amplified. So someone opening a refrigerator, the lights become brighter, noises become louder. All of a sudden, I'm like, holy shit, what is happening? And all of a sudden, I had to literally remove myself, go outside, scream at the top of my lungs in the middle of fucking New Orleans. People were probably like, what the hell? Well, it was New Orleans, so that probably was not uncommon. Release it. So I felt so embarrassed because I'm like, I'm an adult human being, like hosting this event. And I just had to do that to regulate myself, to be able to be a part of this event. It was very challenging, brought up a lot of shit. Don't want to diverge too much. But these things can really take over, and they can be really destructive, and they can be really damaging internally. This shame spiral is really, really hard when that comes over you.
So hard. So hard. Yeah, absolutely. Oh my gosh. First of all, being in a kitchen with 25 people, like, I could never. It's like, yeah, that would be so hard to be like, I am like in charge of all of these people, making sure they have a good experience. And then I've got to go like release this energy through like a human yell. Like, oh my gosh, Patrick, that sounds so painful.
And then, yeah, that was not fun. So that was a good moment to reflect on. But again, like you said, exit ramps, being able to remove myself and knowing that I needed to remove myself and not just enduring and not just sitting there and being like, you're going to white knuckle and you're going to power through this, because that's not how that works. And
it's not, it needs to be released. I love your word release. It needs to be burned off. There's tons of cortisol going through your body. You've got to release it. And having helpful, that's another like plan ahead thing, having what are healthy or helpful ways I can release this. So again, yes, like I talked about in adolescence, for me, it looked like self-harm. And for a lot of autistic people, it looks like self-harm. And that makes sense to me. So having, especially if that's something that you're struggling with, a listener, like kind of having a toolkit ready to go of alternative ways of releasing, punching bags or yelling, or I don't know. Yeah. What are some other like vigorous walks, although that's hard because sometimes depending where you're walking is also a sensory overwhelming place, but like physical movement, like intense physical movement. What are some, besides yelling, what are other ways that you found to release the meltdown energy?
So if I got a soccer ball and she went out to my backyard, I started kicking the soccer ball as hard as I could against the fence. If I did jumping jacks in my living room or like something that really got my heart rate up pretty quickly, that helps a lot as well because you're kind of getting some of that cortisol out. You're getting some of that adrenaline out. The endorphins start going, but it starts to kind of like regulate your system a bit. This is an unpopular opinion with some people. I don't know why, but I love rage rooms. Like I love them so much. There's one I just opened near me. I go like once a month and I brace shit and it is unbelievably cathartic. So I think hot showers, those can be helpful for me. So if I like step into like a scalding hot shower, put my hands against the wall and like push against the wall, that can really help ground. If my dogs are not the cause of said meltdown, you know, spending time with them, taking them on a walk and just like you said, walking kind of like with pace and intensity can be really helpful too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I love those. Yeah. Hot showers for me too. That's kind of my go-to is a really hot shower. Back when my body would let me like intense, like weightlifting workout sessions, with like loud music in my ears.
Yeah.
Intensity, right? Like getting the body to match, like if the intensity matches what we're feeling, I think that can help release. Yeah. It's interesting. I thought we'd end up talking about shutdowns more because I know we're both of us have a default towards shutdowns, but I do think meltdowns, there's like a specific shame around it. There's a danger to it. So it actually makes sense that we've ended up lingering more on meltdowns.
Yeah, for sure. One place I find myself with emotional meltdowns is like someone trying to explain how to do something and I can't figure out.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. And like they're explaining it as if it's like the easiest thing in the world. They show you the diagram. They show you like a live demonstration. They ask you to repeat it or you try to repeat it. You can't internally just beat the shit out of yourself and immediately shut down and melt down emotionally. Mm-hmm.
I'm so glad you said that because that is the other place I'll get meltdowns. And it is interesting. I'll be more likely to meltdown than shut down. And it's kind of like a cognitive overload. If someone's explaining something to me and it feels like it should be simple, but it is not simple to me and I'm not tracking and it's frustrating. And I think there's something about like, you're not getting me, you're not getting my frustration that then exactly. Like amps it up. But yeah, that's another place where I will have more, not, I wouldn't say a full meltdown, but I'll get like, in my stress in a way that is unique to me when I'm trying to follow directions and they're not making sense, which is like pretty common for me, actually.
Pretty common for me too. My spatial awareness and intelligence and ability to follow a diagram, ability to put something together is non-existent. And I get so unbelievably upset. And I think what you just named is exactly it, especially if someone else is involved. Like you're not seeing how hard this is for me. And by no fault of their own, most of the time, it's just like, you don't see it. You're not understanding how challenging this is. And that is creating this shame dynamic or component and it is then creating a meltdown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't ever ask me to go to IKEA. I will melt down.
I literally was just thinking that. I was like, you probably don't like IKEA furniture.
No. God. Yeah. Okay. What's the...
Okay, shutdowns. So if meltdowns are like that cortisol fight flight, shutdowns are when we're in that kind of dorsal shutdown, not necessarily a full-on freeze state, but like that freeze mode of the nervous system. And this is what, the first time I heard this was Finn Grodin's book. They talk about faux regulation. And this idea, this is part of what is so kind of disorienting about a shutdown is that it, to other people, you might look really calm, but your cortisol is still through the roof. your stress response is still very active. You still have to release that energy, but you can look calm to the outside observer. And there's been a few like interesting studies out there, but one suggests that autistic people are not necessarily more likely to shut down than to melt down, but more likely than like holistic people to respond to stress that way. And so where people around them might have no idea they're stressed, but actually they're in a stress state in their nervous system. For people who mask a lot, they tend to be more prone to shutdowns. Because again, if you think about masking, it's about like internalizing, taking in, hiding. And so they tend to cope with more shutdowns, which again is one of the reasons their autism often goes undetected, because they're navigating the world through like a disassociated fog. So, and when I'm in shutdown, I feel dissociated. I feel like I'm in a dream. I feel things feel slower. What about you?
Yeah, the exact same. I think I feel that way, if I had to conservatively guess, like 80% of the time in my existence. So I'd feel like you're kind of like holding it all together if you're masking and like for the outside world, right? So whatever situation you may be in, it might be an unbelievable amount of energy and effort going on behind the scenes, which is then again why people are so depleted and exhausted in social situations and professional situations, et cetera, in high sensory environments. So that's kind of what it is for me too. And I feel like my default coping mechanism is escapism, which is typically immersing myself in like the same TV shows over and over again I know I like, the same movies that I watch over and over and over again, where I can basically be vacant and not have to be attuned to the world around me. And that's kind of the only way I've found to recharge through this, is like that type of experience.
You're saying that's what helps you come out of a shutdown is repetitive. Yeah. I like the imagery of kind of melting out of a shutdown. Oh, that's weird, because there's meltdowns that maybe doesn't work. But it's like a slow, right? So if in a meltdown, you need to like kind of aggressively release energy, you almost need to like warm up a shutdown with a slow. Yeah. I want to use the word melt.
So we've got a coffee percolation, you know, it's like just slowly brewing or coming back to, I think, instead of releasing all of that as much as you can or as intensely as you can.
Yeah, exactly. It's a more like gentle. It's really important to be gentle with the process. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, if we're going to circle back to attachment stuff, I hate where my mic is right now. It's driving me crazy. I think in any sort of attuned, healthy attachment, secure attachment place, if you have a partner involved and you're in that place where you are doing what you need to do to kind of come back from that shutdown, that acknowledgement without having to have that response or that responsibility. And what I mean by that is, if my wife walks into the house and the windows are shut and it's dark, which it often is, and she's like, oh, you're watching Lord of the Rings or you're watching Game of Thrones, I'm not going to talk to you until you talk to me. That has been really helpful for me, because then it feels like I don't have to exist anywhere except in this form, in this state right here. And I don't have to take on anything else, because I don't think I'm capable or able to take on anything else right now.
I love that. I like her so much. She knows you so well. And of like, I'm not going to put any sensory demands on you or like unexpected social demands. Yeah.
It's really helped. Oh, let's talk about other sensory stuff that can lead to a shutdown. Intense smells, that
olfactory.
Olfactory sense, like that for me is the most challenging of all the senses, aside from tactile and like temperature. So if she's cooking, she'll take the air fryer. If she's using the air fryer outside on a porch now, cooking in the house, because that smell will literally make me shut down to the point where I'm not able to be present anymore, because all I can focus on is how uncomfortable I am with that smell. And it's really challenging to get away from. And I'll smell on everything. I'll smell it on like my coat. I'll smell it on my sweatshirt on the back of the door. I'll smell it like on my blanket in my bed. And I'm like, I can't, I cannot exist right now.
That's so interesting. I haven't thought about like mapping senses to shut down or melt down, but that'd be an interesting thought experiment. I don't like, for me, smells are terrible and I'll get headaches and I'll feel nauseated. I'll probably kind of get more anxious. I won't, for me, those won't be a shutdown trigger. For me, bodies, like just being in a room. So like when you said you were in a kitchen with 25 people, I would be shut down from the start. Like if I'm in a room of more than, I would say, four people, then my body's in shutdown mode. Yeah. And sounds will shut me down so fast. Sounds and bodies would be my two like huge shutdown triggers.
Bodies are hard for me. It's a weird phrase.
Bodies are hard for me.
Because of the work that I do, especially these events. So like, I have to now mentally, and I agree with you 100%, I'm in shutdown mode 90% of the time in those. And I am like, because I'm doing 4 to 5 a year, I'm like having to anticipate said shutdown, knowing that when I host the next event, which is in 2 weeks here in Asheville, there's 27 people coming. 27 people are going to be in one room in one space a lot. It's face right now.
That sounds like so gross to me. Like I'm like
the face you made. Was, you made the face of like yeah,
disgust. Anyway.
Yeah,
is that disgust. It? Disgust. That's, yeah, that's, I think that's what I felt. Disgust.
Yeah, like, you were like. Yeah, so having to mentally prepare and anticipate to be in that environment to absorb that energy, knowing that I'm going to have to disassociate. For the majority of the time. And we just did an episode on substances and alcohol and gambling. That's where, I'm not proud to say it, but that is where I will often reach for alcohol, is because I'm going to know that I'm going to be immersed in a state where my body is just, it can't be present. It cannot exist in that room. So it's really hard.
That's also when I would drink the most, was because shutdowns, they're uncomfortable. And so that was because, and alcohol like has a way of numbing, but then it's like, it's a more pleasant numbing. And so that was absolutely an alcohol trigger for me, was like, I'm not in my body, but it's going back to control, right? Like if I'm not in my body because I'm tipsy, because I'm choosing alcohol versus because I'm shut down and this is out of my, that was probably one of the biggest alcohol triggers for me was shutdowns.
For sure. I agree. And I think it comes down to like, if you're constantly in that shutdown space, right, where you're not in your body and you're dissociated and you're really struggling to be, it's really hard to be still. It's hard to be like, even if I'm sitting on the couch watching something and I'm in that mode and I'm like so uncomfortable within myself that it's so hard to just exist.
Yeah. Well, similar to meltdowns, I'm curious what you do, like the more helpful things you do to get out of a shutdown. Like for me, I've noticed this is really interesting, Patrick. I've never been able to. I cannot talk about dissociation without dissociating. Like it, just the topic of it will actually. So I've actually been much more shut down since we've switched the topic. So I noticed a few minutes ago, I started gently like swaying back and forth, and now I'm swiveling in my chair. And that's one thing, talking about that, like kind of slow warm up. I'll start kind of gentle rocking or swaying as a way to kind of, it helps me from getting like too deep in the shutdown, I think. That's one of the things I do to help regulate. Hot showers. Hot showers are just, they work for everything.
They're just the best, yeah.
Except pots. They that kind of sucks about pots is then hot showers can activate other things. But yeah, hot showers, that's been a big one. I will do walks more when I'm shut down because the grounding of the movement. And so that's actually I'm more likely to walk when I'm trying to like move through a shutdown. Music, that's when I'll do stim. I'll put on like a stim song. I have this beanbag chair. It's called like the Zero Gravity. It's a ridiculously expensive beanbag chair, but it's amazing. It like supposedly like mimics zero gravity. So I'll lay in it, I'll put a weighted blanket on me, and I'll put my stim song on. So pressure, weight, repetition. Yeah, repetition. That's what you said too. But those are the things I'll go to after a shutdown.
And I think the big differentiation here, right, comparatively to meltdown, is the intensity. It is like you're not looking for the intensity. You're not looking to get the intensity out. It's about soothing. It's about sensory soothing. It's about like slow and gentle, like introduction. And I agree with walking. It's just kind of like getting back into your body, like just noticing the weight on your feet, just noticing the way that your feet feel against the ground, like just noticing the temperature that it is outside. I'm petting my dog with my left arm, by the way. So like that is also one of those things where like, so just, you know, petting your animal or hugging your animal. So that helps me. Hot showers. Yeah, that's my go-to for almost everything, regardless of what mood I'm in. I'd say also just, repetition. I have like a weighted sloth stuffed animal thing that my friend Tara got me, so I'll use that. I need it to
Is it a wormy?
I don't think it is.
Just got a wormy. And that, so it's like a weighted stuffy, but you can also put it in the microwave?
No, it is not.
Okay, so I just found these. These I think would be great. Especially for meltdown recovery, wormies or a stuffed, like just weight. But I love that you have a stuffed sloth. That's perfect.
Didn't want to buy it. Sent it to her. I was like, I want to buy this. The therapist says I should, but I'm an adult man. Like, I don't want this stuffed animal sloth. All of a sudden it shows up at my house a week later. I'm like, did you fucking buy this for me? She's like, yeah, you need it. And you should have it. So inner child reparenting, also helpful for some of this stuff. But yeah, I think these are good strategies. These are all the ones that I do. I can't think of anything that I'm doing differently. I do think just vocalizing it sometimes, if you can, to if you have a partner at home or a friend or a roommate or whoever, just making it known, like, this is the space that I'm in, can be helpful. Because again, having that person reciprocate with, I'm just not going to talk to you for an hour, or I'm going to just like not expect anything of you for an hour, can be really freeing and helpful too. So.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Yeah. The other thing I'm thinking of is, for me, I know loops are that you can put them in your ear. They're pretty discreet and they take sound down by like 15 decimals. Yeah. Whenever I'm going into a group context, I typically wear loops, and I know that my threshold is a lot, like I have a much larger capacity before I shut down. And so that's been one accommodation that's been helpful for me is using sensory blockers. And that's where I'm really intrigued with your idea of like smell as a trigger for shutdown. Like, I don't know if there's any science to that, but I'd be so intrigued about it in the exercise of mapping your sensory triggers to, like, if one is more likely to flip different states. And so if you know you're like going to go into a noisy environment or a bright environment, thinking through like what accommodations ahead of time will expand your capacity.
And this is where like good tactile sensory and fidget toys come into play too. And I know so many people have similar responses. Like, I'm an adult. I don't want to bring a fidget toy out in public. I challenge you to think differently about that. Like, if you can put a rock in your pocket or something with a different texture or edge that you can just touch, or something small that you can just be playing with, can really be helpful too. And I have those things all over the place. Like, I'm constantly going from one to the other based on like texture and temperature and other things. So
it's just occurring to me, like, how much sensory regulation you and I have both been using throughout this whole conversation that's not going to be visible to most people. Like, I have a weighted blanket on my lap. I have a swivel chair. I have a like puffy thing with a lot of texture that my feet are on, and I keep like grabbing onto it for texture. I have a poppet. You have a dog next to you that you're petting. You've had fidgets. Like, there's so many sensory things that we've been doing this whole hour. It's just interesting to realize that, think on that.
It's been kind of strange to reflect on that, saying like, now I understand the things that I need for accommodation versus 34-ish years of not knowing or not having good awareness and not doing these things and how much more challenging that life was. One thing I'll say with everything we're talking about, because a lot of you have DM'd me about this because, you know, I travel a lot. How do you navigate this while traveling? And it is very, very challenging. I just want to be transparent. And that's where I would bring the weighted blanket with you in your backpack or your bag or a weighted pillow or the weighted stuffed animal or the fidget toys. Because if you want to talk about sensory hell, the airport and the airplane is kind of the epitome. Because it's, you know, the odors, the sounds, the smells, the bodies, like it's just, it's a lot. So I actually witnessed my dad have a major meltdown in the middle of the Madrid airport because he did not know he was autistic at the time until I told him, like I told you about the story, but he lost his wallet on the plane and it was right as we got to Spain and literally meltdown in the airport, like hitting himself in the head and calling himself stupid and all the things. I had to like help him soothe and ground and regulate. And those environments can feel really overwhelming for people because when we talk about control, talk about any complete lack of control, when stuff like that happens to you unexpectedly in environments that are in the public, so really, really hard to experience.
Absolutely.
Why did I just diverge there? I don't know.
All I know is sensory. I mean, sensory shutdowns, meltdowns. Like it's all fair game.
Yeah. So you know, that's where that was my little like insurance way to be like, hey, here are things you can do to support your sensory system. This is why these things keep happening to you in these types of environments. Like, I think the more education we can provide to you and the more resources we can provide, the better.
Totally. I kind of feel like a broken record at this point because I feel like I talk about sensory regulation all the time. But in this, so Self-Care for Autistic People is releasing in March, which probably be shortly around this time that this is released.
We could time it that way for that reason.
Yeah. But I like with, so the way it's the structure of the book is like 100 tips, self-care tips. But I was with the editor and the publisher, I was like, okay, but we need like a more robust chapter on sensory self-care because this is the bedrock of self-care for autistic people. And this is often what gets missed. So the first chapter is all on sensory self-care. And honestly, I was so limited in my words. I wish I could have said so much more, but the important part, I'm not trying to plug the book. It feels like it sounds like I am. What I'm trying to say is in my brain process, I was like, we have to start talking, like any conversation on self-care has to start with the sensory. Because if we start talking about these other like higher level things and we're trying to put that on top of a dysregulated sensory system, like it's just, it's not going to stick. It's not going to do anything.
Yeah. It's like throwing gasoline on fire. So, and plug your book. I mean, hell, this is.
That feels, I'm bad at that stuff, Patrick.
I'll plug it
back. Promo.
I know. You worked really hard on it, though. It's going to help a lot of people. So that book will be at the release of this episode because it's going to come out around that time. Make sure you get it. But I agree. It's the foundation. And if you don't have the foundation taken care of or at least attended to and don't have the awareness around it, it becomes so much more challenging because then it becomes a situation where either you, your therapist, your friends, your colleagues, your doctor, whoever is like, Have you tried this? And you're like, I'm so dysregulated that I can't try any of that. So I'm really glad you named that and help. It may lead to a part two of the book that you're creating.
That's actually in the works.
I know you too well.
You do. Yeah. No, but sensory self-care. Yeah, I think that is just such an important part of wellness for us and for ADHDers too. You know, like I know we often focus on the autistic, but ADHDers often have a lot of sensory stuff going on as well.
Totally.
Yeah. I feel like we're in the wrap up zone.
Yeah, I think so. I think we're in sync today. It's weird. I haven't seen you in weeks, but I think this episode was great and I'm glad we had it because I think we could have spinoffs of this, honestly, like such an important topic, sensory systems in general, and all the ways that things show up. So, I think we're done. I think my voice is getting out too, which I'm noticing. So I think we're really done. And to everyone listening, new episodes are out every single Friday, all major platforms like YouTube. Buy an egg in the book. It's going to help you quite a bit. And what is it called? Self-Care for Autistics by Dr.
Self-Care for Autistic People.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. And we will link that when it's available, because you worked really hard on it and it deserves to be celebrated. All right, everyone. Megan's going to feel awkward now.
I am.
Having the eternal grossed out expression of me being so, 25 human beings.
I'm going to say this though, because like it is a promo, but it's also like it's so relevant for this. And I think it can help people. Exactly. I'm doing for my people on my newsletter, but I'll extend it for my podcast. I'm doing a special promotion where if you pre-order the book, you'll get a free NeuroDivergent Insights workbook. And I have a workbook on sensory regulation. So if you're like resonating with this, and if you want to go buy Self-Care for Autistic People, you do that so that you get the sensory regulation book for free or any other workbook. So basically you'll get a coupon code to download that for free if you pre-order Self-Care. And I can put details on that promotion in the notes.
Sounds good. All right, everyone. We will talk to you in some way in the next week. So thanks for listening. I hope this was helpful, and goodbye.
As you may know from listening to our podcast, I've been working on a book, Self-Care for Autistic People, and I'm excited to announce it's out this month, both in physical form and as an audiobook. As a celebration of its release, I'd like to share some excerpts from the audiobook edition with you, our podcast listeners. The book is designed as a book you can pick up for brief, easy 5-minute reads with over 100 different entries that introduce you to practices for incorporating self-care. You can find the audiobook wherever audiobooks are sold, available on March 19th. Enjoy.
Whether you mask or not, it's important to learn how to take care of yourself in ways that actually reward and nourish your brain, instead of using self-care ideas that are created from a neurotypical lens. That's why the tips, ideas, and information in Self-Care for Autistic People are tailored specifically to address sensory, emotional, relational, and professional challenges so you can feel more aligned with who you are and build a grounded and expansive life. Self-Care for Autistic People includes information on how to work with your sensory and nervous systems, find practices to help you self-advocate, and discover ways to limit burnout. Starting a self-care practice may seem overwhelming, so take your time and focus on the chapters that resonate with you. You can also start by implementing a few practices at a time.
And now here's another excerpt from the audiobook edition of Self-Care for Autistic People, that touches on one of my favorite subjects, sensory detox.
When I worked in hospitals and universities, I would invariably return home each night shrouded in palpable fatigue and plagued by a persistent low-grade fever. It was a puzzling malaise that seemed to persist without a discernible cause. My revelation came when I realized I was experiencing sensory overload to such a degree that my body was interpreting it as a physical illness. My autistic child and I now referred to these as sensory sick moments, when we feel the wear and tear of a high sensory day. Once the onset of sensory sickness begins to creep in, I know it's time to initiate my sensory detox routine, a series of calming and restorative activities designed to rebalance my sensory system. This might involve taking a hot shower to cleanse and refresh, changing into my most comfortable clothes, or sinking into a beanbag chair cloaked in a weighted blanket while indulging in the rhythm of my favorite stim song. I might also turn to my trusty TENS unit for relief. TENS units, short for transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulation units, are these handy devices that provide mini electrical zaps or pulses. While they are predominantly used for pain, they also work to provide repetitive sensory input. When I engage in these rituals, I can feel the harsh sensory residue of the day gradually dissolve. Your sensory detox will be as unique as your sensory profile. While I find solace in stillness and weighted comfort, you might prefer an energetic walk or music. Explore and identify what suits you. Then curate your sensory detox ritual, a haven for those intense, high sensory days when sensory sickness looms.
And now, pause for a word from our sponsors.
From new patients faced with an empty lobby and no idea where to find their therapist, to clinicians with a session running overtime and the doorbell ringing, some of the most anxiety-ridden moments of a therapy appointment happen before a session even starts. This episode's sponsor, The Receptionist for iPad, helps you tackle some of that pre-appointment apprehension and anxiety. The Receptionist for iPad is an easy-to-use digital client check-in system that helps your visitors check in securely to their appointments and notify their practitioners of their arrival via SMS, email, or your preferred channel. No more confusion, endless lobby checking, or having clients sign in on paper logbooks. It can even help you upgrade and update your demographic information for your clients as well, and even validate parking. Start a 14-day free trial of The Receptionist for iPad by going to thereceptionist.com/private practice. Make sure to start your trial with that link, and you'll also get your first month free if you decide to sign up.